Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, April 18th, day 9 of our spring fundraising campaign. This morning, we talked to Governor Josh Green about the reports looking at the timeline and emergency response to the Maui wildfires. And in the waning days of the legislative session, we talk about priorities his administration was hoping to get consensus on. Will a special session be needed? We also had a Hawaiian interview about a photography exhibit focused on Lahaina and its people that now has new context in the wake of the wildfires. You know, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. It has been 24 hours since the State Attorney General's Office released the first of a three-part investigative report into the Lahaina wildfires. The state paid $1.5 million to the Fire Safety Research Institute and is expected to extend the contract for two other reviews, which will include a possible cause of the deadly wildfires. Here's a clip from the news conference with Attorney General Ann Lopez.
A few days after the wildfire, I was speaking with the governor, and he and I were asking the same questions that everybody else was, which is, how could something like this have ever happened? During that conversation, he and I both agreed that good governance demanded that we investigate how state and county government functioned during this process. What policies and procedures were in place that worked? Which were in place that didn't work, and then determining why to those questions. And then finally, being able to understand the facts and the whys so that we can obtain recommendations about best practices for policies and procedures so that the state policymakers can move forward in a way so that this absolutely never happens again. And I want to be clear that it is my mission and the governor's mission and belief that we do this right, that we do this transparently, and we do this based on science-based evidence and facts. After I left that meeting tasked with this investigation, I contacted two people to ask if they could assist me in identifying who might be able to carry out such an investigation. I contacted the director of FEMA and the United States Fire Administrator. Both unequivocally said Fire Safety Research Institute generally and Dr. Steve Kerber specifically. As a result of those conversations, I contacted Dr. Kerber, and he and I had a series of conversations. Not knowing very much about fires like this, I had a lot of questions for Dr. Kerber, so we ended up talking through many points of how to proceed. I had a few requirements as part of this process. The first is that this investigation has to be completed within 12 to 18 months. The people of Hawaii can't wait 4 years or 5 years for this report to come out. We need to do it now while things are fresh in our minds so that we can get to work. The second part is I didn't want to engage in an investigation that might take 18 months and not have anybody know anything during the investigation. So I wanted to be able to break this up into phases so that at the end of each phase, I could report to people, to the people of Hawaii, and they could be engaged in what is happening. The next part that I think FSRI and I share deeply is the importance of transparency. It is part of FSRI's mission to be transparent in the research and the work that they do, and it is my belief that we must be transparent with a situation like this. So today, we are releasing, or we have released, the Phase 1 report, and again, it details minute by minute what unfolded from August 8th through August 9th. The Phase 2 report will come out in late summer, maybe early autumn, I'm not sure, but that phase will be an analysis using these facts combined with the emergency management plans, the policies and procedures that were in place at the state and county level to understand what we did right, what we did wrong. And then the final phase will be released before the end of the year, and that will include from FSRI's research-based understanding the best practices and for policies and procedures and priorities on a going forward basis, so that policymakers in Hawaii can get to work figuring out how we move forward and keep everybody safe.
That was Hawaii Attorney General Ann Lopez talking at a news conference yesterday, which laid out the Lahaina wildfire timeline, which showed some communication gaps as that disaster was unfolding. We will hear from Governor Josh Green coming up right after this break.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years of preparing Hawaii's future business leaders for global opportunities. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
You know, earlier we played a clip from the news conference that was happening right when we were on the air. And this morning, we spoke with Hawaii Governor Josh Green to get his thoughts about the timeline of events outlined in the Attorney General's report on the Lahaina wildfires. Here's Green.
Well, it brings back a lot of emotion. Of course, the tragedy is extraordinary, and to see it minute by minute, it's pretty jarring. What we have been happy about is that, you know, 8 months been able to really piece together everything that has happened. And this, of course, complements the discussions we've had with individuals that were there on the ground. I was with a survivor last night who lost his wife. And these are just very real moments. What I take away from it, at least this first part of the report, and there will be three parts, is that it was a perfect storm. That's not a cliche. The nature of the fire, the nature of the storm that was going on, combined with just longstanding challenges as far as resources go, all came to bear that day. And I'm glad that we're able to just be honest about things and what happened.
Yeah, I mean, it was chaotic, and you know, unfortunately, you know, key information maybe didn't get transmitted fast enough to the right people. But it is important to get the facts and map them out.
Yes. And there are going to be a lot of reports. You know, there was even a report that was filed by the fire department on Maui just the day before. And it's consistent with everything we're putting out and seeing, too, which was there were heroic efforts by firefighters and police and so many people. But things were not perfect. There was a great deal of challenge where communication had to be better. There also, you know, is obviously going to be chaos when you have a fire that's moving around at 70 plus miles per hour with winds. So that none of that surprised me. But again, you're going to see a lot more updates because sometime in the summer, toward the 1 year anniversary of the fire, ATF will bring out their findings. I think that's when you're going to be able to get very discreet comments about what actually started the fire, what could have been done to mitigate its spread, and so on. That's the expert team that does that. Right now, our attorney general is making sure that we have all the facts. And look, you can obviously read this report, which is not short, and you can take away a lot about, you know, what we wish had been done better. But you also should take away, if you're reading it objectively, the extraordinary work that so many people did. And this is going to inform us going forward because right in the moment, we are passing budgetary changes so that we have more resources to fight fires. We're looking at a fire marshal statewide. Our team has already been implementing a series of major harm reduction measures. And I'm talking about things like putting sensors out there. We are in the process of ordering some additional machinery that can give you an idea of how bad a red flag warning is in the area. Of course, we're doing fire breaks. All those things are happening in real time, but this has to be the future for our whole state and really for our country.
We have listened to the conversations that were ongoing as we were trying to get through this, you know, the initial few weeks, you know, after the disaster, about our resiliency and the telecommunications failure, how vulnerable we really were, and we didn't know it at the time. Obviously, the focus is being better prepared to prevent another disaster like this. But was there anything else that you were struck by?
Well, to be fair, you know, I've been able to see a lot of reports as governor in the last 8 months. I mean, I've been getting vignettes from people and departments as we go. So for me, though it was the first time I saw it all in one place, I had heard and seen much of this information. I'm struck by just how fast the fire moved. Honestly, if I'm just speaking off the cuff, it was shocking. And I've heard people tell me that the fire moved through their house like it was a freight train. And that's what was expressed by the firefighters during the fire and in the aftermath. So I guess that's the most telling thing. I also was struck by the way the fire spread up in the air and the fire pattern. When you saw that visual from, you know, from the report, and you see the fire cascade down the mountain, it, you know, it kind of validated what we had been hearing, but to see it that way was something. It's really still, though, the human stories that impact me the most. I'm spending a lot of time talking to families that lost a loved one, and they are so strong and so brave. And it's incredible when they tell their part of the story. So I think this is important. I think it's practically incredibly important because we have to make sure that we can keep ourselves safe. It's also very therapeutic, I think, for society to go through the process and try to make things better. And to not just relive it, but to actually know, you know in certain terms what happened.
Well, in my limited conversations, you know, with the first responders, you know, to hear them describe that it was like dealing with a blowtorch, you know, the intensity. And then the moments, just really minutes, that many families had to get out of harm's way and get their families, their children, to a safe spot. It's stunning what those firefighters and police and all our first responders were up against that day.
It's incredible. I mean, some of the fire trucks, as you know, were overtaken by fire themselves and melted. And that's something that I had never heard before. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot to take away from this first part of the report, and the subsequent reports will come out in a few months, with a spread of about 3 or 4 months in between, in time for the next legislative session to have a lot of additional changes. Although I'll just keep making sure that we do at least all that we can do to prepare ourselves and share with the world what can happen. We're not the only ones that are, you know, vulnerable like this. In fact, unfortunately, much of the world's vulnerable like this. And I would venture to guess that we're going to have a new global approach to red flag warnings. I think people are going to have an escape bag in their house where they take their essentials with some of their ID, knowing that, you know, God forbid a fire can't be contained, that they will be safe, but they can get out and rebuild faster. Because, you know, right now, much of my time is spent making sure that we're getting people into long-term housing, that we're doing the debris clearance, that we're preparing with the mayor's team to do the, you know, the new permits for people's houses. I mean, that's all the recovery part. But we're also looking back to see how we'll be safer. And that's why I'm really appreciative of these reports.
Are you comfortable with the timetable or the time that it's taken for this first report, you know, to be released?
We wanted it faster. There's no question. The truth be told, everyone's working at like 300% capacity, so I'm not going to blame anybody. And it's very sensitive conversations that are taking place, so I understand. I always want information sooner, but you should never rush a product. Frankly, you should get good results and accurate products. Otherwise, they're useless. So I was very pleased with the Attorney General and her team. And, you know, I'm not pushing back on anybody. I'm just saying we're going to all do our job going forward to make Hawaii safer. This is a 50-year plan that we're trying to put together. So we're safe for generations. And in the immediate moment, of course, we're putting in extra safety precautions. But we want the whole, you know, the whole gamut of recommendations to be correct. And so this was one of the early parts of it, and we're not going to spare any expense to make things safe. So that's where we are right now, and there will be very good milestones met in the coming weeks, months, and so on for the people of Maui. So there's just so much to share, but yesterday was a big day as far as reporting goes.
That was Governor Josh Green, and we will have more from our conversation that we had with him this morning right after a break. Well, let's get back to the conversation that we had with Governor Josh Green this morning. State lawmakers began meeting in conference committees this week to hash out differences on key bills. One issue that has emerged this session is that we're on the verge of an insurance crisis. The Maui disaster spurred the insurance industry to rethink risk, and policies are being canceled and rates are soaring. House Speaker Scott Sike warned that the state could lose one of its handful of insurance carriers, which could be disastrous. Lawmakers are weighing bills to help stabilize the market. Here's Green.
I do hope that the bill will pass that provides kind of stopgap insurance protection for us going into the future. And I'm prepared to see us move monies like the hurricane relief funds over to that. I think that was a good idea. I do think there should be contribution from the state, and we need to secure our ability to insure our condos and properties and everything. I've also tasked my team in the interim, when it's coming soon, to, if there's no bill, prepare to look at resources that are coming from our rainy day investment. The rainy day fund, which has $1.5 billion, generates about $50 million a year. And that may very well be the right place to take resources from, that gain, the growth from that fund, and use it towards securing our state from a safety standpoint and an insurance standpoint. As you see, there's been a lot of reluctance to have extra general excise tax, or more specifically the TAT tax. That's really what was proposed, or the $25 climate impact fee. There seems to be a reluctance to do that. So I'm looking for other ways to secure our future, and I'll keep fighting to do that until I'm no longer, you know, doing these jobs. So that's important. So we have two, to put a fine point on it, we have two chances right now. We have the legislature, and hopefully they'll pass that bill. If they don't, I will put together a blue ribbon panel to make sure it's ready to go for next year. And finally, if we did have a sudden turn for the worse as far as insurance goes, I obviously would be prepared to bring my colleagues from the legislature back into, you know, a week or two session if we really had to care for our people. That's always available to us if necessary. It's clear that we can no longer just expect to legislate during the, you know, the 4 months at the beginning of the year if we have a big disaster. So I'm always going to be ready for that. There are some pretty straightforward solutions, so I'd love to see them happen at the, you know, kind of the 11th hour here at the legislature.
And, you know, you set a priority for your administration going into this session. You know, some of the things, as you mentioned, have gone by the wayside, you know, the visitor fee, that kind of thing, you know, recreational marijuana. I don't know, anything else that you're looking at, you know, as the lawmakers tackle these last 2 weeks?
Well, we've had a lot of success in the recovery. The GAP plan appears to be moving forward again. And, you know, this year, it was just tax day, you know, this week, actually, we're starting to see those tax breaks from last year become a reality for Alice's family. So that's good, and that's going to keep going. We've resolved, you know, a lot of our concerns about Kauhale. We're accelerating our Kauhale program like crazy, which is a big success. And we're still waiting on short-term rental legislation that can bring some of those houses back to our local families. So lots of big successes. There's always a couple things that just don't make it. We also succeeded on the One Ohana Fund. We're getting a lot of people who want to move on with their lives and, you know, allow us to help them if they lost a loved one. So the legislature has done some great things, but we still have a few big items out there, and it may very well be that the climate fee or the green fee still needs more time. But Mother Nature moves in long cycles, and so I'm okay just getting there gradually. But there are going to be fires. There are going to be tsunamis. There are going to be hurricanes to deal with, and so kind of my job as the emergency room governor to get us ready.
We have been looking at different ways to try and speed up the process to get the displaced families in Lahaina into the long-term, you know, shelters, and I know there's a backlog with criminal checks and that kind of thing. Any update that you're getting on that end?
Yes, there was actually, we doubled the rate this last 2 weeks, so we went from 70 families a week to 140 families a week now. So right now, there's 876 families, households still in the, you know, the NCS, the hotel sheltering, but that's down from our peak at 3,071. So 71.5% of everybody has now moved out of the hotels and moved into longer term housing. And it's really speeding up now. Plus, we're about to get a building called Hagai, which has 175 units. That's on May 1st. And we're building houses now. We've broken ground and we're starting to clear the way for this summer and fall, have those houses land in the Lahaina area at Le'ili'i. So it's a lot of progress. Also, 16% of all of the lots of that's been fully cleared, which means people are going to be able to get permits sometime in the next few months to rebuild their homes. And we're going to accelerate that to about 40% of the properties cleared in the next few weeks because it's really going faster. So there's big progress. I'm going to start giving Monday updates about five major indicators starting on, I want to say maybe May 6th or May 8th, something like that, where we're going to just start pumping out these key indicators so everybody sees exactly what it is. I mean, I know people can watch me on the whiteboard and I can give them this there, but we're going to continue to give these updates. And it looks good for having most of the residential lots cleared before we reach the one-year mark. And I don't think any state or country has ever gotten anywhere near that. So I want to give a lot of credit over to the Army Corps and FEMA and HIEMA. All those guys have really done their job. I just want to thank everyone for being so committed to helping our communities on Maui recover. But also know that we are not going to miss a beat. We're going to continue to make sure all of our ideas and programs statewide continue to move forward. And that's why, you know, I'm insisting that we do tax breaks for families that are on the edge, and then we continue to work on our large housing crisis. You know, these are things that you can't take a year off of. So we're honored to do this job, but it's mostly been doable because so many people have pitched in.
All right. Well, thanks again, Governor. We appreciate you carving out some time for us.
You bet. Take care.
We've been hearing from Governor Josh Green. This week, the results from two independent investigations were released. The Western Fire Chiefs Association hailed the efforts of our first responders as they found themselves dealing with what some called a mega fire there in Maui. The Attorney General's report released a timeline of the wildfires, the first of three that will be released this year. And a separate probe on the cause of the fire by Maui County and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is also still pending.
Support for HPR comes from the University of Hawaii, presenting Reimagining Homelands, a retelling of ancestral memories through Japanese and Okinawan music and dance, April 20th and 21st at Leeward Theater.
You know, we wanted to share a recent conversation about Lahaina that we aired earlier this month. Photographer Arifin Graham's exhibit, The Last Resort, features black and white photographs of people in and around Lahaina. It was named after the song by the Eagles and recently wrapped at the Chapel Gallery in British Columbia, Canada. The photos were taken in 2022 and feature images of everyday people in their element doing everyday things there in Maui. His photographs have taken on a new context in the wake of last August wildfires. In addition to being celebratory, they are now historical. The conversations Russell Subiono recently got the chance to talk with Graham.
I was born in England, grew up near Calgary, Alberta, on a ranch, and my first experience of Hawaii was being taken to Waikiki at the age of about 4 years old in 1960. And that's where I got the smells and the feel of the water and the sound of the music. And I realized through this that that's where my love of Hawaii really began as a young boy. And then I went to school, you know, back east in Ontario, and then I went to San Francisco Art Institute to study photography in the sort of mid to late 70s. And it was actually my father who really got me interested in photography initially as a boy. And then I studied at San Francisco Art Institute with a guy called Perkel Jones, who was a longtime friend and associate of Ansel Adams, the great American landscape photographer. And Perkel did a project with Dorothea Lange, another great American photographer from the 20th century, called The Death of a Valley that was being flooded in Napa County, California, for a reservoir in the 1950s. And Dorothea Lange was commissioned by Life magazine to document the last year of this valley, this beautiful valley, this rich farming community and town that was there, and they were being evicted, you know, because California needed the water. And that influenced me hugely. And that piece of work that they did, documenting a community that they knew was going to disappear. And then I didn't do black and white photography for about 40 years. But I always sort of kept in mind that I was doing black and white street photography in the 1970s in San Francisco. And I sort of left that behind. And then one day in Lahaina, 2 years ago right now in April, it was Earth Day, April 22nd. I was down at the end of Lahaina where Mala Wharf is. And I just saw these three images, one, two, three. And I just felt that these were really compelling images. They're of local people. And I knew that this was going to be an interesting portfolio of work and that it would be called The Last Resort, which is named after the Eagles song from 1976, right, in which Lahaina figures hugely.
You can leave it all behind. You sail to Lahaina just like the missionaries did so many years ago.
And the song is about how we find paradise and kiss it goodbye. I always felt that song was an important song environmentally, socially, culturally, and really foretold. You know, as Don Henley said, it's the history of Western civilization in 7 minutes. And then Lahaina figures so deeply and prominently in the song as being the last resort. You know, we can leave it all behind and sail to Lahaina. And then, alas, what they were writing about at that time, you know, really came true last year. And so I felt that as a photographer, as an artist, and just as a human being, I had spent many years in Lahaina. My parents had a place there, which really, that love of the aloha spirit of Maui, of Lahaina, of paddling, you know, all those things that we love to do there. And at the same time, I got to know people who live and work there because my parents had a place. At one point, we needed to fix it up. Our rental agent said, you know, we can't rent it anymore. You got to fix it up. So it was my job to find the tilers and the plumbers and the drywallers and the painters and the handyman. Darren, he was fantastic. And all these people who I engaged to do this work. And I would make trips from Canada to Maui and we'd get this work done. So I really got to know and appreciate people who live and work in Maui and who also keep that place going for the millions of people who come from around the world who absolutely love the place. It was all that really prepared me for this moment, which was kind of like an epiphany, of seeing these three images down at the end of Mala Wharf, three different images of people doing different things. It was that really was the foundation that allowed me to see Lahaina and see Maui in a certain way and with love. Really, to me, that's kind of the basis, the love of this place that I think is what really is the catalyst that propelled me to do it. And then the work just continued as I met people around Lahaina and around Maui. And I always ask people, may I take your photograph? And there's that wonderful moment of engagement with people who I've only just met, maybe I've met them a few times. There's that moment of engagement where we really just as human beings, we are there for that moment. And then something of their life, their spirit, their humanity is revealed.
I thought it was very interesting that in many of your photographs in this exhibit, people are aware of the camera. How did that change the nature of the experience, especially in today's context?
Yeah. So 2 years ago, Maui was a very different place. It was a place where a guy like me, who I'm not a resident, I'm a visitor, could go around town and it was just whatever I was doing. When I met Kevin in the Ed 76 gas station, when I met Joni, who was at the Salvation Army, and when I met Kirk Bowes at the Lahaina Art Society at the Banyan Tree Gallery in the old Lahaina courthouse, I think people were really open to it. And I think it's a matter of being sensitive and finding a way of, I'm there to be with them, not to sort of take something away, if you will. My wife and I are coming back to Maui in a couple of weeks. We haven't been there since 2022. And people ask me, you know, what's the next stage of this project? What are you going to do next? And honestly, Russell, I don't know what's next. It's to be revealed. At the same time, I know that there is a particular sensitivity in Maui. And I understand there's even a sign in the airport, at Kahului Airport, that asks people to be very sensitive. Please be aware. This is a very, very hard time for a lot of people. So for me, as a photographer who really liked to engage and for that moment of engagement with people, I don't know what that looks like now. And it has to be done very carefully. And I don't even know if it's possible now. One thing I think about is seeing if I can find some of the people who I photographed and to check in with them, be able to say hello and say, hey, how's it going?
As you were taking your photographs, and I read that you took them over, I think, a couple of different trips back in 2022. Yes. What were you looking for as you were taking them?
I think I was just looking for authenticity and to look at a place that so many people consider paradise. And it really is. It truly is a kind of a paradise for we human beings, you know, globally. It's kind of what we think of. But it's authenticity and it's looking at the place in a way that I think people often don't look at it. You know, these are certainly not touristic photographs. Yes, I have a lovely beach photograph, but for the most part, it's really finding that moment of authenticity and seeing people who perhaps are not always seen by visitors. It might be the person, you need to go into the gas station, you're paying for the gas. It's just a person there doing a transaction. It's a transactional thing. Whereas what I'm looking for is the relationship and seeing people who they're looking around and recognizing people for their humanity and for their individual life, no matter what they're doing. And certainly to engage with the local people. And that goes back to the people I met who live and work in Maui and really trying to just find that authenticity and see the place from a different point of view, you know, not normally seen, I think.
Now that your photographs have kind of this new historical context that really shined a light on what Lahaina was like before the fires, is there any chance or any opportunity that you might be able to bring your exhibit to Maui or to Hawaii at least?
Well, thank you, Russ. I really appreciate that question. Well, when I was there in 2022, I met Jonathan Yukio Clark, who is now the director, I understand, of the Schaefer International Gallery. And I told him in 2022, it was at a photographic workshop, and I said, Jonathan, I've been working on this series of black and white photographs of Lahaina and, you know, like to make a proposal for an exhibition. And so he said, November 30th is when you need to get it in by, just send it on in. So I actually missed the timing for 2022. And then, of course, the fire on August the 8th last year happened, and all of a sudden the photographs have a far greater historical importance. And so I didn't miss that due date last November. I certainly got it in and haven't heard anything back yet. However, I have perhaps hoped to check in with Jonathan while we're over just to see how things are going. But I'd love to be able to show the pictures there. And at the same time, I'm sensitive about timing because I know that emotions are, there's so much destabilization in people's lives. And so is it the right time for these pictures? Or is it a bit later? I don't know. That would really be for those in Maui to understand that, because I think it's so important that the number one thing is, how are people doing? How can we help in that rather than adding burden? Or if these photographs are seen as being interesting or useful or you know, of interest to people to see, then what would the timing be as well? I think that's important. But I'd love to share the photographs with people in Maui and any of the islands, really. And I think it is important that we see the places that we know and love, because environmentally, the world is changing, and let's do what we can to record the places that we know, the people, and also do what we can to make this a good world for our, you know, future generations.
Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Great to talk with you. Thanks so much. Aloha.
That was photographer Arifin Graham talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about his Maui Focus exhibit entitled The Last Resort. We were glad to be able to hanaho that story for you. And that is our show for us today.